Welcome to the Valley Brook Community Church podcast, and thank you for joining us online today. You're about to hear a message from our current series, Sunday School. For those of us who grew up in Sunday school, there are stories from the Bible that we will never forget. We are taking a fresh look at these stories and placing them into the context of the greater biblical story. To watch any of our previous messages or learn more about what is happening at Valley Brook, we encourage you to visit www.valleybrook.cc. Enjoy!
A nice little, you know, jig to it. You couldn't see, but Pastor Clark was just sitting in the chair doing this, so I was just doing it with him. Good morning, everybody. Happy Sunday. Happy Sunday. So glad to see everyone this morning. So I want to start off this morning. I want to share with you something that's been on my mind for a little bit. As you guys know, for many of you who are here, if you're new to Valley Brook, you maybe don't know this, but right now at our church, we're going through a pastoral transition over the course of the next year with Pastor Clark's retirement coming up next year. So, that was his wife. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Pastor Clark was the founding pastor of Valley Brook, and he has been the lead pastor and shepherd here for 26 years. Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your leadership. I know that this makes you very uncomfortable, but Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount that people will see your good works and they will bring glory to the Father in heaven. So we see that, and we are giving God glory because of what you and your family has done. So thank you. Thank you so much. So one of the town hall meetings that we went through during this phase, during this transition and the pastoral transition like discussion and everything, I got to answer some of the questions that the congregation had about leadership in the church and some, you know, some decisions of where we're going forward. And someone asked me a question that I still think of weekly. Someone asked me this question. It's an unbelievable question. They said, "Hey, how do you measure success? What is your measure for success?" I love that question. If you know who you were that asked that question, thank you, because that was such an awesome question. And I think about it, I know I gave my answer and I stand by what I had said, but I still think about it frequently. And I think it's probably best if we do too, because if we're gonna keep doing this church thing, I think we need to know what our answer to that question is. What is our measure for success here at our church? How do we see success? How do we know that we've gotten it? How do we know we're going in the right direction? You know, honestly, I think right now too, just in our culture, I think that that question is something that we're still all trying to figure out right now. Like we're trying to figure out, I feel like answering that question, how do we measure success, could honestly answer a lot of the issues that we're dealing with. Politically, do we feel like we know what our measure of success is? Probably not. Mainly, I think, honestly, in that area, I think we have different end goals. So I think that's sometimes part of the problem is I think we have different end goals, so our measure of success doesn't line up with everybody. I think that's part of it. But what about us in the church? We all have the same end goal. Our end goal is Christ on the throne. It is God's kingdom come here on earth. It is everything made right. It is every single person that believes in the name of Jesus living eternally with him forever. That's our goal. We all have that same end goal. But how do we know that we're reaching it? Do we know what the actual measure of success is? Do we have the same measure of success as somebody next to us in the church? So I looked up online and I was doing some research on this. And what I've learned is that for most people, we have two definitions of success, and what that means is that we bob and weave between thinking success means either this or this. It's not just you could define it this way or this way. It means that when we think about this, we move back and forth as time goes on. One day we might say this, and one day we might say that. The first one, first definition of success, is the achievement of intention. It's pretty basic. You achieve what you set out to do. Success is, I want to do that, and I did it. So the achievement of success, or the achievement of intention, is the first definition. The second one is the attainment of wealth, fame, and power. Not weird. We confuse those two things. That means on one day we may think success is, hey, I just did this thing, but on other days we might look at success and say, well, it's getting more money. It's getting more influence. It's getting more notoriety, more honor. And we bob and weave between those things. Do you feel this in your life? Have you noticed when you bob and weave from one definition to the other? I do all the time. I'll be totally honest with you. One area that I feel this tension in me, I get really, really uncomfortable when I'm in like very well-off areas, when there's like really big houses, when I meet people who are all part of like a golf club, or like we're out at like a dinner and it's on the water and these people come in on their boats. And they come in and they get out and they're like, I'm part of the fancy club. Not if you have boats, I'm sorry, I don't mean to diss you. But like, I get very uncomfortable when I'm in those situations. Why? Because before I decided to go into ministry, when I was in my undergrad, I was gonna go work at Morgan Stanley. I was gonna go work at a financial firm. I had a job lined up already. I just had to go and finish the degree. And so there's a part of me that knows before that if I had gone down that road, I might have been able to own those things. I might have been able to have a big house like that. I may have been able to have a boat or go to a golf club. I don't like golf, but you know what I mean. But I get uncomfortable even though I decided to move away from that and go follow and be and work for the ministry, there's a part of me that one day I'll go, yeah, the ministry, the goal for everything is we want Christ's kingdom here, I gotta serve this. And on other days I go, ooh, did I do the right thing? Because that looks pretty nice. Do you feel this? I feel this. We all have that tension somewhere in us when we move back and forth between those two things. My prayer is that we know where God's measure of success is. And so what we're gonna be doing, this tension that we have, this tension between those two sides, that's our next step on our journey through the classical biblical stories. We here at Valley Brook, we like to take our summers to do a study on one topic or one area. And what we've decided to do this time is to go through all the Sunday school stories that usually children learn about as they're growing up in the church. They learn about Adam and Eve and Noah and the flood. They learn about Jonah or Moses and all these different stories that you might see them make VeggieTales episodes of or different kind of movies. And so what we're doing is we're going and we're looking through those, but now we're doing it with adult eyes. We're gonna look through this and see what these stories mean and what, where in the setting they fit. Because we believe as adults and here at Valley Brook, we believe that all these stories do not stand individually, that they are all a part of a larger narrative that leads to Jesus. So when we look at these stories, we don't just say, hey, this cool thing happened and then we move on. We go, no, how does that point to Jesus? What's going on that happened previously that is now being addressed here, and how is it still moving and moving and moving till we get to the King of the world coming? And so a few weeks ago, we saw God dismantle Israel's oppressors when they were in Egypt. They were enslaved. And we saw God dismantle the power of Egypt, and not only that, but he dismantled every single god and idol that Egypt worshipped, everything that they believed would bring them success. All their gods that he brought in, God came in and knocked them all down. The story is not simply that Israel was freed from slavery, but that God had conquered every single power that Egypt believed in and showed that he is ultimately powerful and they are ultimately powerless. In this story, Israel did not free themselves. It is by God's power that they were saved, and that became who they were. That they did not do it themselves, that God did it for them through his might. That Israel story was an obvious story, an obvious example that there is a God that cares for people and that he is powerful. Israel saw that deliverance with their own eyes. They saw miracles happen and the tragedy is that they couldn't remember it. They forgot it. They forgot what it meant. May we never forget what happened in Egypt. That is my prayer for all of us here. May we never forget what happened there, because it matters for our lives just as much as theirs. And so we heard last week, Pastor Clark brilliantly described the story of Joshua, the next leader after Moses, after they had left Egypt, and how they'd moved into the promised land, a land that once they had acquired, God promised that this would be their base camp for becoming a blessing to the entire world, that this was the base camp of being the blessing, of bringing all of God's desired ends into the world. And we heard Joshua lead his people into the land, but after Joshua dies, Israel begins looking and living like everybody else. They abandoned where they were supposed to go. They started to trust in their own means of success and did whatever they wanted. Honestly, in the scriptures, if you read it, it just says everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And what happens during this whole season is everyone starts to deal with the detriments of when everyone lives in their own way. When everyone lives by just living by what's right and wise in their own eyes, everyone began establishing success in their own ways and began judging good and evil on their own. We've talked about this at length before as a congregation, that is a really bad thing. And it doesn't lead well to good places. God raised people to bring them to justice, to rescue them from the damage that those decisions brought them into, including repeatedly being subdued by other nations, falling into depravity through idol worship, and just some awful stuff. If you read the book of Judges, it is rough. It is definitely not a PG book. But they keep drifting back again and again. So eventually they realize, oh, I think we're messing up. Okay, I think we know the problem. They think they have the solution. They say, you know what? Instead of returning to God, their solution is we should become more like everybody else because these other nations aren't having this problem. So we should become more like them. So what do they want? They ask for a king. They ask for a king to lead them. They muster together and they demand that they want a king. A king was a strong military leader who would represent them to the nations. He was a symbol of their national fame, wealth, and power. Do you see the tension here with them? They feel it too. And so God warns them multiple times about the dangers of doing this, but out of their pleading, he allows it. And so they pick someone who fits their desired part, someone who looks successful in their own eyes. So they pick a very Pharaoh-like king. They pick someone tall, powerful, young, and from their wisdom, successful in everything that he does. It's kind of the qualities that Egypt worshipped, if you notice. So they remember the wrong thing about what happened in Egypt. This king's name is Saul. And so he is the first king of Israel, and he too becomes commissioned by God. He gets into this position, and God takes an opportunity to say, okay, hey, look, bro, this is what you need to do. This is what the people are supposed to be. This is what you're supposed to be. You need to lead them in this way. And for a while, he does it. For a while, he tries to look to God and follows him in everything that he does. But when things start to get tough, in moments of tension, he abandons God's wisdom and starts to go about it his own way, the same kind of way everybody was doing before. And so, to a degree, some of it actually works out for him a little bit. He does have some success in some ways, but eventually it lands him into a lot of trouble. And this lands us at a point where confrontation takes place, where God's plan for a new king comes into play. And this is a story of David and Goliath. I assume you guys have heard this story before, whether you've gone into church or not. It's a very well-known story. And so this is where the adult eyes are needed. This is where we need to put on our thinking caps. That was a very teacher-like thing to say. And we're going to read this in a moment. This is the classic story here, and it's a showdown between the new king of Israel, because David becomes the new king, and it's a showdown of him and the giant of Israel's enemies named the Philistines. But the confrontation, and this is something a lot of times people miss, this is where the adult eyes come in, the confrontation is really between Saul and Goliath, not David and Goliath. Let me explain. So Saul is the king. And kings were battle leaders and signs of strength and leadership and power in their armies. And Saul's been pretty good at it, pretty victorious, what he was supposed to do, even through his own means. But that wasn't what Israel was supposed to do. That wasn't who they were supposed to be. They were supposed to trust God and allow him to win the battles. We learned just last week about the Battle of Jericho, where they did things that looked foolish in the eyes of the world, but they were victorious, and that was evidence that God is with them and that he is who he is. That was supposed to be their purpose. Their entire purpose was to be a people that proved that there was a God and that he was with them and that he helps and he saves. They were supposed to be proof of that, not by their own strength, but by God's strength. It was supposed to be so abundantly clear. But Saul does not do this. He tries to win by the might of his own strength. But the inevitable happens. He comes face to face with Goliath. Now, here's a little analogy for this that I think is really helpful, and this comes straight out of my nerdy brain, but this will help us as we read through this. So I just watched recently the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. I love those. I think they're so much fun. Parents, please do your due diligence in deciding when it's okay for your kids to watch those movies. Please do not be like, the pastor watched it, let's go. And it's like, so please do some due diligence. But I love those movies because Batman's so cool. He's just so cool. He's creepy, but he's cool. But he's creepy because he's always in the, you know, shadows and stuff. But anyway, I love those movies because in the first two movies, he is more trained, more equipped, and more physically capable than any of the bad guys. So he just wipes the floor with them constantly. It's not even like funny. He just like walks in. You're like, he's just so much better than they are. But then you get to the third movie, and he meets Bane. And Bane is just as trained, actually a little bit more equipped, and definitely a lot more in shape. And so he humbles Batman fast. Now, the reason I bring up that nerdy little side thing is because this analogy, what we see here is we see Saul slapping around a whole bunch of other nations because he's strong and equipped and tall. But then he comes up against his Bane. He meets Goliath, who is more equipped, he's more trained, and he's bigger. And so this humbles Saul real, real fast. And this is where Saul realizes, and for the rest of us, this is something for us to remember as well, there is always a bigger Goliath out there. And so when we read this story, I'm going to read through this chapter of 1 Samuel. It's a little long together, but I really want to do this. It's really helpful. But when we do this, I want you guys to look at how Saul acts in the face of someone bigger and stronger than he is. And then see God's example of what Saul was supposed to be. Let's read this together. This is going to be behind me up on the screen. This is 1 Samuel chapter 17. It says, the Philistines now mustered their army for battle and camped beneath Socah at Judah and Azekah at Ephedamin. I'm going to skip through that. Saul countered by gathering his Israelite troops near the Valley of Elah. So the Philistines and the Israelites face each other on opposite hills with the valley between them. Real quick note on this. Neither army would want to move from that position. They are both at the best battle position, so they're at a stalemate here. The valley is like being in the trenches. You don't want to be there. Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. It says he was over 9 feet tall. Now, in some of the manuscripts, it says he's 9'7", and in some manuscripts, it says he was 6'7". Regardless, he's a big dude. A big dude. Back then, 6'7 is like 9'7 today. Enormous guy. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. Do you even lift, bro? He also wore bronze leg armor, and he carried a bronze javelin on his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was as heavy and as thick as a weaver's beam. It's like this big. It's crazy. Tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. His armor bearer walked ahead of him carrying a shield. He had so much stuff, he needed two people. Goliath stood and shouted a taunt at the Israelites. Why are you all coming out to fight? He called. I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. Choose one man to come down here and fight me. If he kills me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel today. Send me a man who will fight me. When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. Now, David was the son of a man named Jesse, and he was from Bethlehem in the land, I skipped over the hard word, from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. Jesse was an old man at that time, and he had 8 sons. Jesse's 3 oldest sons were Eliab and Abinadab and Shimeah. I practiced this, and it said they had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. David was the youngest son. David's 3 oldest brothers stayed with Saul's army, but David went back and forth, said he could help his father with the sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, every morning and evening, the Philistine champion strutted in front of the armies of Israel. And one day, Jesse said to David, "Hey, take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers and give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain. See how your brothers are getting along and bring back a report on how they're doing." David's brothers were with Saul and the army is the Israelite army at the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with these gifts, as Jesse had directed him. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelite army was leaving for the battlefield with shouts and battle cries. Soon the Israelite and Philistine forces stood facing each other, against army against army. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, and he hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Then David heard him shout his usual taunt to the army of Israel. As soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run away in fright. "Have you seen this giant?" the men asked. "He comes out each day to defy Israel. Now the king has offered a huge reward to anyone who kills him. He will give that man one of his daughters for a wife, and the man's entire family will be exempted from paying taxes. Do you see what Saul is turning to in order to win his battles now? He's using his money. He's using his family, his wealth, and his reputation. Whoever wins this, you'll be royalty and you don't have to pay taxes. That's the success he's using. It ain't working." Says David asked the soldier standing nearby, "What will a man get for killing this Philistine and ending his defiance of Israel? Who is this pagan Philistine anyway that he's allowed to defy the armies of the living God?" And these men gave David the same reply. They said, "Yes, that is the reward for killing him." But when David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard David talking to the men, he was angry. "What are you doing around here anyway?" he demanded. "What about those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know all about your pride and deceit. You just want to see the battle." "What have I done now?" David replied. "I was only asking a question." He walked over to some of the others and asked them the same thing and received the same answer. Then David's question was reported to King Saul, and the king sent for him. "Don't worry about this Philistine," David told Saul. "I'll go and fight him." "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There's no way you can fight this Philistine and even possibly win. You're only a boy, and he's been a man of war since his youth." But David persisted. "I have been taking care of my father's sheep and goats," he said. "When a lion or bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club and rescue the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. I have done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too. For he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine." Saul finally consented. "All right, go ahead," he said. "May the Lord be with you." Then Saul gave David his own armor, a bronze helmet and a coat of mail. David put it on and strapped a sword over it and then took a step or two to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things. Real quick, little side note here, Saul doesn't even have as much armor as Goliath does. The king of an entire nation is not even as equipped. They're showing us he doesn't have enough of the worldly stuff to make it matter. He goes, "I can't go in these," he protested to Saul. "I'm not used to them." So David took them off again. He picked up 5 smooth stones from the stream, and he put them in his shepherd's bag. Then, armed with his shepherd's staff and sling, he started across the valley to fight the Philistine. Goliath walked out towards David with his shield bearer ahead of him, sneering at contempt at this ruddy-faced boy. "Am I a dog," he roared at David, "that you come at me with a stick?" And he cursed David by the names of his gods. "Come over here and I'll give your flesh to the birds and wild animals," Goliath yelled. David replied to the Philistine, "You come at me with sword, spear, and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied today. Today, the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your head, BT-dubs. And then I will give the dead bodies to your men, to the birds and the wild animals, and to the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And everyone assembled here will know that the Lord rescues his people, but not with the sword or spear. This is the Lord's battle, and he will give you to us." I just get motivated when I read this, right? It says, as Goliath moved closer to attack, David quickly ran out to meet him. Reaching into his shepherd's bag and taking out a stone, he hurled it with his sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank in, and Goliath stumbled and fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine only with a sling and a stone, for he had no sword. Then David ran over and pulled Goliath's sword from its sheath, and David used it to kill him and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they turned and ran. The men of Israel and Judah gave a great shout of triumph, and they rushed after the Philistines, chasing them as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. The bodies of the dead and wounded Philistines were strewn all about the roads as far as Gath from Ekron. Then the Israelite army returned and plundered the deserted Philistine camp. That is the word of the Lord. Valley Brook, what we see here is that God picked a shepherd, not a warrior, who is young and inexperienced in war and not professional at all. God uses David to wipe out the enemy because when David goes, it is not David's power he goes out with, but the Lord's. David may be inexperienced in war, but he is seasoned in trusting God to be his protection. David walks around unarmed into battle with the most heavily armored person. This looks to the world like it's going to be the complete opposite of success. Like David's going to walk in and be absolutely crushed and say, there's no way this will succeed. This is a thing that we see as people who follow God. We see this regularly, that things that the world thinks will lead to death, God uses to bring life. God brings life out of the things that we see and we say, that's foolish. But he brings victory. God entrusts a shepherd to lead his people, someone who will care for them and be a model for them to follow. Sheep follow their shepherds and their voices, not because of military might. When you have a shepherd, you have a leader, a protector, and a servant who cares for you and your growth and your life. This is the kind of success that God desires. Let our leaders be servants. And everyone here at Valley Brook, hear this. May we understand that first and foremost, to be a leader is to be a servant. That is how God calls us to be. Someone who does not reach for the sword, but trusts in God's power and the gifting that God has equipped them for the work that he has called them to do. And it is not David's power that shines bright here. It's God's power that shines bright. The miracle isn't even that the stone killed Goliath. Slings back then were like medieval pistols. That was not the miracle. The miracle was a person going unarmed into this battle knowing God will protect them. That's the miracle. And we all know that. It's harder to move our hearts than it is to have a fight. It's so much harder. God does not use the sword or the spear to make his plans work. God's kingdom is never secured by trusting in human strength. He does it through willing sacrifice on the part of the believer. That is where God shines brightest. In our weakness, we are made strong. In the sacrifice That is where victory comes from. May we never think that God's weapons are the weapons of the Philistines. May we never think that the weapons that God uses and the tool that God uses to bring about his kingdom are the weapons that Saul wanted to give to David in that camp. But trusting God. So David becomes the next king of Israel and is described as a man after God's own heart, meaning he trusted in God and he knew God, which allowed him to succeed and know what to do. Most of our book of Psalms is written by David. He was a writer and he was a songwriter. And if you're here and you want to learn more about how to pray and how to connect with God, I highly recommend reading through that book of the Bible. There's so much wisdom from a person who trusted and knew God through his highs and his lows. Now you'd think and hope that David would not fail then, that he'd be a king that knows what to do, but boy, oh boy, did he fail. And you know what's really funny here? For most of us growing up, we were taught that his big failure was David and Bathsheba, where he killed a man and stole his wife. Now that is indeed really bad, but he had an even bigger royal mess up that came later. For those of you that know the Bible, do you know what it is? Because it's usually not emphasized as much. There is a time later, as David was king, he pulled the Saul. He went back and did what Saul would do. In a moment of tension and fear, David takes a census of his armies as king. Now, back in those days, taking a census of their army is not just, hey, I want to see how many I've got. It's a preparatory act for battle. He's saying, I want to make sure how much might I have, how many swords I have, how many people I have, because when battle shows up, it's going to determine how I do this. Basically, what that means is David went back into Saul's armory and started putting on armor. He messed up. And so God punishes him for doing that, to try to wake him up. And he gives him three options for a punishment. He says, I can either kick you out of office for a little bit, but you'll be back and you're gonna be running around, or there's gonna be a plague or a famine, but the plague or famine won't just affect you, it's gonna affect your people. And David, in a moment of cowardice, said, that's too much for me, I can't do this, put it on the people. So he makes them suffer for his failures. This is why the scriptures speak of the need for a new David, a new king. A king that would not fail, a king that would trust God forever and never turn away. It says that that king's throne will never be vacant, that his rule will never end, that he will be king forever. A king that when the moment came, he would take the consequences on himself rather than making the people suffer. Valley Brook, we know that that king is Jesus. That is King Jesus. King Jesus came in. He is the shepherd king who we needed. He came not with a sword or spear nor military might, but as a servant. This is what Israel's king was supposed to be, a servant leading a servant people. He did not fight and he did not hold fast to the idols of fame and wealth and power. Instead, he sacrificed himself for his people and took shame and poverty and took the stance of a servant. Those things the world thinks would lead to death. And Jesus sacrificed on the cross, they thought they won. But just as God does, he took what looks like death and brought victory and life to the entire world. We are now all saved because of King Jesus' sacrifice in that moment. In a moment where he laid his life down, he was not afraid, he laid his life down, and now everybody has life. Anyone that believes in his name comes into that life and power and victory of the King of the world. Church, we need to check ourselves and rethink what we think success looks like. If we continue to have the same measure of success that Saul did and David when he was in his weak moment, we will miss the king of the universe doing what he does best. Think about those moments of tension in your own hearts, like the one I have. Whatever that is for you, Contemplate that through prayer and meditation on the scriptures. Consider where in your hearts are you giving allegiance to the things the world thinks bring success. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up now. Consider in your hearts where you need to trust God. Where is your definition of success? When moments are tight and tough, do you turn to the weapons of the world through fame or poverty, or through fame or wealth or honor? The idols of the world, St. Thomas Aquinas writes, are power, money, pleasure, and honor. That we give allegiance to these things over any other things because they make us feel like we're being successful, but they always fall short and lead to death. Valleybrook, consider where your definition is. Find in your hearts where you lean the other way. And pray and meditate on the scriptures and see where real success comes from. It comes through sacrifice and following Jesus, for he is the true king. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for sending Jesus. Thank you for sending us the king of the world. We need him. Lord, we were all in enslavement to sin. Sin is stronger than any other power this world has. It dominates like no other. And Lord, you defeated it by laying down your life and sacrificing as the true leader and servant. You freed all of us. Lord, that freedom is not by our power. There is nothing we can boast about in this, but it is your power that freed us. Lord, may we remember that like the Israelites were supposed to remember Egypt, that it is by your power and might that we have been delivered and commissioned, and that we have been commissioned to live like you lived, to live as servants who do not follow the things of this world because we know that they will bring us down and certainly lead to death, but that we will live by your power and might and your example and your spirit, and that we know if we do that well, we will see your kingdom come. We will see real success. Thank you. In your name we pray, amen.
Thank you for joining us at Valleybrook as we engage in this series. To learn more about the life of our church and how you can get involved, visit www.valleybrook.cc. If you're interested in contributing financially to Valleybrook and to our ministry, you can do so at valleybrook.cc/give. Wherever you're joining us from, we hope this message blesses you and encourages you to love God, love people, and change the world.